Maria Jose's life came to an unexpected and tragic end. When she was 13, she went back to live with her mother, and one day in 1970 she was found dead. She had apparently committed suicide by taking formicide mixed with a soft drink, dying almost at once. The Psy underworld had finally claimed her. 1. I took the file back to the IBPP office, where I found research director Suzuko Hashizume and secretary Virginia Bresson at work putting a new file together in their usual neat and thorough way, with transcripts of taped interviews, press clippings, background material and investigators' field reports. Hernani Gomez Andrade was drafting a letter to his French colleague Emile Tizane, a retired police officer who had spent much of his life investigating poltergeist phenomena in France. Well, he asked me, what did you think of the Djibouti Cabal case? Very interesting, I replied. But why do these things only seem to happen to uneducated teenagers in remote rural areas? Haven't we got any good black magic going on here in Sao Paulo? Hernani opened a drawer of his file cabinet. Here, he said, take a look at this one. It's still being investigated, and the person concerned lives just around the corner. Now, from the researcher's point of view, who would be the ideal witness for a case of black magic? A Roman Catholic would be preferable to a spiritist, since the latter would be predisposed to believe in it. A trained psychologist would be even better. Somebody with such qualifications ought to be able to find rational explanations for the phenomena, or at least would try to find them. I read through the file and decided it was too good to be true. Then I made arrangements to meet the person involved, and I soon decided it could be true. The young woman, whom I will call Marcia, struck me as a sensible and well-balanced person. With her Catholic upbringing and master's degree in psychology, she did not seem a likely candidate for a black magic curse. However, at the end of May 1973, when she was 28, Marcia went for an outing with her aunt Elma, during which they went for a stroll along one of the many beaches that make up the Brazilian Riviera either side of the port city of Santos. As they walked along the edge of the calm ocean, Marcia caught sight of something lying in the sand, just beyond the reach of the waves. It was a small plaster statue of a woman, about 6 inches high, and most of its paint had been washed off by the waves that must have lapped around it at high tide. Marcia thought it would make a nice ornament for the apartment in Sao Paulo she shared with another young single woman. She stooped to pick it up. Better leave it where it is, Elma warned. She recognized it as a statue of the sea goddess Yemen J tilde inverted exclamation mark. It was a long time from August 15th or New Year's Eve, Yemen J tilde inverted exclamation mark s two traditional feast days, but somebody had evidently been making a private offering to her out of season. The statue was her property, like the white flowers that would have been thrown into the sea along with a request of some kind. Catholic psychology teachers have no time for superstition. How can a statue do any harm? Marcia said, as she picked it up. Elma said nothing. She was not a spiritist or an umbandista, but she had heard about people who interfered with those ceremonies. Marcia took the statue of Yemen J tilde inverted exclamation mark back to her apartment. Although the sea had washed most of the paint off, it still had one blue eye, a skin-colored area around the lower right jawbone and neck area, and smaller patches on each arm and on the back at about the level of the right lung. It made an attractive ornament. She propped it on the mantelpiece and promptly forgot about it. A few days later she was violently sick with food poisoning after eating a piece of chocolate. This had never happened before, although chocolate was a normal part of her diet. Hardly had she recovered from the initial effects of the poisoning, when she began to lose weight rapidly and feel generally run down. She became pale, her skin taking on a greenish-yellow tinge. She began to lose her memory and to find difficulty in relating to her work, surroundings, and friends. Her colleagues at the faculty where she taught asked what was wrong, but Marcia said it was just the after-effects of food poisoning and would soon pass. Then she had a hemoptysis, spitting blood from the lungs or bronchial tubes. She went to a local clinic for x-rays and a thorough checkup. The first X-ray, taken on July 4, 1973, showed a patch in the right lung that could mean tuberculosis. She was given a Mantoux test for allergic reaction to the TB bacillus and a sputum test which came out positive, meaning that she did indeed have a form of TB. Nothing paranormal about that, but what was rather unusual was that within 5 weeks she was pronounced free of the disease, which usually takes a year or longer to treat and can often be fatal. The doctor told her to have a good rest, and Marcia went to stay with her parents in the small town 300 miles from São Paulo, of which her father had once been mayor. The little statue of Yeman J. Tilde inverted exclamation mark stayed on the mantelpiece of her apartment. A few days after her return from a two-month stay in her peaceful hometown, Marcia's pressure cooker blew up in her face, showering her with boiling beans and water. She suffered second-degree burns on both arms and on the right side of her face and neck. She was rushed to a first aid post for treatment, and spent the next few days resting at home. Then the gas oven exploded. There were three people in the kitchen at the time, when a sheet of flame shot out of the lower part of the stove, which was unlit, directly towards Marcia, as if it were trying to reach her. Marcia immediately fetched a plumber who took the stove apart and could find no explanation for the incident, in which the door of the oven had been blown open suddenly, although the spring hinge was new and strong. Marcia decided to trade it in for a new one, just in case. A few days later, a friend visiting São Paulo from her hometown told her that at about the very moment her pressure cooker had exploded, her photograph had jumped off the wall of her parents' home. There had been no wind, the string had not broken, and the nail had not fallen out of the wall. The photograph had simply jumped to the floor. Every good psychologist knows that coincidences will happen, but to Marcia there were getting to be too many of them. A friend mentioned that her statue of Yeman J. Tilde inverted exclamation mark might have something to do with them. Nonsense, she replied. How can a statue do anything? She gave her friend a lecture on the principles of behaviorist psychology, in which she had been trained and taken her master's degree, and which she now taught at a university faculty in São Paulo. Behavior is something that depends on external forces, she explained. I can only evaluate what I can really see. Any interior, or non-observable event is not relevant. There cannot be any relation between a statue and a burn or a dose of TB. The textbook phrases came tumbling out. Behaviorism, the school of psychology founded by J.B. Watson, reduces a human being to a mere object situated between a stimulus and a response. It explains such crucial life situations as whether or not a woman accepts an invitation to lunch, but it does not explain the appearance of a Michelangelo. Arthur Koestler, in The Ghost in the Machine, calls it flat earth psychology. The behaviorist B.F. Skinner has made the earth-shattering discovery that the mind does not exist and suggests that so-called mental events should be ignored or rejected. Still on her best behaviorism, Marcia decided that her TB had been brought on by her lack of resistance after the period of food poisoning. The pressure cooker explosion was bad luck. The oven incident was just another incident. These things happen. They went on happening. While Marcia and her flatmate were crossing the busy street outside their apartment building, the flatmate dropped the car keys. As Marcia bent to pick them up, the lights changed and cars roared past her on both sides as if on the first lap of a Grand Prix, missing her by inches. As she crouched on the road, she had a sudden impulse to commit suicide by flinging herself in front of a car. But she managed to fight it off and eventually reached the safety of the island in the middle of the road. Some time later, as she was opening the window of her 15th floor apartment, she again felt an impulse to kill herself. It was like a voice inside me saying, "Go on, throw yourself out," she told me. Again, she was able to resist. One wonders whether some cases of suicide are the results of such impulses felt by people without the self-control to ward them off. Marcia eventually did what Brazilians tend to do in the situation she was in. Casting aside her Catholic upbringing and her behaviorist education, she headed for the nearest Umbanda Center. As it happened, her flatmate knew a good one. What finally made up her mind to take this drastic step was the strange experiences she began to have at night. She had never had sleeping problems before. Her busy schedule and the racket of Sao Paulo, one of the world's noisiest cities, usually made her drop off as soon as her head hit the pillow. But now it was different. She would feel strange sensations around her that kept her awake all night. Her bedroom would be full of, the only word she could find was presences. She felt herself being touched all over the body, and one night came the ultimate horror, the phenomenon known to occultists as incubus. The dictionary says this is an evil spirit that descends on sleeping women and has sexual intercourse with them. The dictionary may be right. Understandably, it took some time and much tact to get the details, which Marcy only gave when we had convinced her that the IBPP never reveals the true identities of its sources without their consent. To a suggestible and frustrated single woman, an ordinary erotic dream could easily be mistaken for an incubus. Marcia, however, is neither suggestible nor frustrated, and old enough to know the difference between an erotic dream and something else. It is slightly unusual for an attractive and intelligent woman in her late 20s to remain unmarried in Brazil, but Marcia was one of the new generation of Brasileiras who were reacting against centuries of male domination and making careers for themselves in many professions. She gave us a straightforward account of the facts. She had, she said, felt the sensation of complete coitus. She had felt the weight of a body on top of hers, and the presence of a male organ, in her own words, inside her. She had never been able to identify the face of this entity, but could clearly recall her efforts to push him away. The experience had taken place for several nights in succession, and had only ceased after she had been treated by a spiritist from her hometown who had unexpectedly turned up one day when she was staying with her parents and told her she needed help. The director of the Umbanda Center in Sao Paulo listened to Marcia's story and immediately told her that hers was a straightforward case of a trabalho, hex, being put to work on her, in revenge for her unlawful removal of the statue. At the insistence of her flatmate, Marcia had mentioned the statue episode and brought it along to the center. It was only at that point that Marcia realized that she had been afflicted in some or other parts of her body that corresponded to the remaining patches of paint on the image of Yemen J. Tilde inverted exclamation mark. The burn marks on her arms, face and neck matched closely, the patch on the back was just about where her first X-ray, which I examined and showed to a radiologist who knew nothing of her case, revealed a lesion in her right lung. True. The statue still had a piercing blue eye, and Marcia would rather not think about what that might have led to. The Umbanda medium told her to take the statue back at once to the spot on the beach where she had found it. This she did at the first possible opportunity, and after 2 months of treatment at the center her problems went away and her life returned to normal. Recalling her 3 months of torment almost a year later, she took a very matter-of-fact approach to the whole business. Previously, she told me, she would not have been able to accept the fact that observable events could be caused by the mere presence of a small plaster statue. Now, she was prepared to admit that they could. It was as simple as that. Marcia is no longer the behaviorist psychology teacher she was, though it must be said that her rational attitude while the phenomena were taking place may well have saved her from a much worse fate. Moral: be careful what you pick up on Brazilian beaches. My second close encounter with a poltergeist took place on September 24, 1974, in a rural area near the small town of Carapicuíba, half an hour by train from Sao Paulo. I read about it in one of Sao Paulo's more sensationalist newspapers, and thought it sounded worth checking out. The paper did not give an address but did mention that the local police had been called in to investigate repeated outbreaks of stone throwing that had been causing damage to roofs and a good deal alarm to the people who lived under them. So I headed for the police station, where I was lucky to find the officer who had been sent to the scene, and was able to tell me how to get there. "This case sounds more like your job than ours," he told me when I had explained what our institute was and what we did. I had difficulty in finding the house, since I only had the street name and not the house number, but posing as a roof repairer, I made some inquiries along the way and found that nobody had heard anything about a roof being damaged, even as it turned out the people living nearest to the houses affected. Finally, I came to an isolated group of six small houses near the end of the built-up part of the road, on the edge of open countryside. They all showed clear signs of having been pelted with stones and bits of brick. Several thick roof tiles were broken, some were missing, and some clean new ones had obviously been fitted recently as replacements. The house nearest the road, which was completely deserted except for a dog or two, had a large concrete block on the roof, which had shattered three tiles. A woman was washing clothes in the next dooryard, and as I arrived, and before I had even had time to introduce myself, she pointed to the block and told me it had fallen at that very moment, or certainly less than a few minutes previously. A promising start to the case, I thought, and wondered if there was more to come. As I soon found, there was. There was a pile of similar concrete blocks near the road, and the only position anybody human could have thrown it from was on the road along which I had been walking for more than 5 minutes, meeting nobody on it at all. It was a sparsely populated area on the side of a hill, and you could see for several hundred yards in all directions. The older children were all in school a mile away, and after we had recovered the block, I asked the largest child around to see how far she could throw it. She couldn't even lift it. I calculated that to throw it from the pile by the road, some 30 feet, would have needed great strength, not to mention a motive. The bombardment, according to the newspaper report, had been going on almost daily for more than 3 weeks. The six families involved agree that nobody visible could have kept it up that long without being caught, especially as the police had been out and searched the area and the residents themselves had mounted a kind of makeshift home guard system, keeping watch in all directions. Less than 10 minutes after my arrival, as I was standing talking to two of the women on the open ground between their houses, I had a closer encounter than I hoped to have ever again. It was so sudden that it was a few moments before I realized what had happened. A hail of stones or pieces of brick had fallen at terrific speed out of a cloudless blue sky, rebounding off the roof of one house onto another at a lower level. I cannot say how many stones there were. I had the impression that they had fallen all around me, and I clearly saw a small puff of tile dust as a projectile struck the roof directly in my line of vision about 10 feet from where I was standing. A small piece of broken tile landed at the feet of the woman I was talking to. I picked it up at once. It showed signs of having been recently broken. Whatever had broken that tile would easily have done the same to our skulls. The two women and I scanned the area, and decided that the nearest house in the line the bombardment appeared to have come from was too far away to be a normal source. It was a good 100 yards up the hill on the other side of the road, and there was no sign of life anywhere near it. This incident was enough to satisfy me that something inexplicable was going on, and I promised to come back with as many of my IBPP colleagues as I could round up as soon as I could. So a day or two later, a carload of us containing Hernani Gomez Andrade, Suzuko Hashizume, Carmen Marino and me arrived, with our cameras and tape recorders, ready to collect what testimony we could, and we were able to meet and question all six women from the houses affected. They were all thoroughly bewildered and frightened by the bombardments. Nobody had been hit directly, though one had been struck on the leg by a stone that had rebounded off the ground. One couple had been inside their house by the open door when a stone had whizzed past their noses as they faced each other a few feet apart. One house, we discovered, seemed to have been attacked more than any of the other five. There were still more than 20 pieces of broken brick and tile on the roof. Would there, we asked, be a teenage girl living there? Sure enough, there would, and she was fetched out to say hello to us. She was a plump and amiable girl, belonging to a family of Protestants who had no time for the spirits, and there seemed to be no reason why anybody would want to attack her. Indeed, after careful and tactful questioning from her nanny, who had a remarkable ability to inspire trust in people of all ages and social backgrounds, we could find no evidence that anybody, living or dead, had any reason to terrorize this group of what seemed to be completely normal, honest and decent people. We asked them to get in touch if the trouble continued, which they promised to do but never did, so we concluded that this was one of those cases that just end themselves without any help from anybody. Another short-lived case turned up just down the road from where I was living in São Paulo in 1974. It involved a very respectable and apparently happy Catholic family with two lively teenage boys. One of them was walking upstairs one evening when he saw an arm disappear into a bedroom. He was alarmed, thinking it must be a burglar, and even more alarmed when the whole house had been searched and everybody realized it could not have been anybody incarnate. The boy stuck to his story after prolonged interrogation from both his parents and myself. There had been phenomena typical of poltergeist activity, I was told. A mirror had fallen from a wall, a light bulb had left its socket and fallen to the floor at an angle of about 45 degrees, a stiff tap had turned itself on within earshot of the whole family, a heavy door had opened just before somebody reached for the handle, and a table lamp had a sudden fit of the shivers in a draughtless room. But on the whole this was rather a half-hearted poltergeist, and I managed to find possible normal explanations for some of these incidents, but not that of the boy's vision of a human arm. This had seriously upset him for a week, and nothing could shake his story. He saw a human arm, period. As at Carapicuiba, I asked the family to let me know of any further incidents, which they never did, so I wrote this off as another of those come-and-go cases. Sightings of disembodied limbs are rare in poltergeist cases, but they were a regular feature of one of the most unusual of the many cases investigated by the IBPP. It was especially unusual even by Brazilian standards, and any account of it could easily be mistaken for the scenario of a very low-grade horror film. For the limbs repeatedly seen by several witnesses were definitely not human. While I was busy on the Ipiranga case described in the previous chapter, Hernani was equally busy with a new case that had come to light in the suburb of Guarulhos. He showed me some photographs he had taken on his first visit to the house affected. They were of chairs and sofas that had been slashed as if by a knife. They looked familiar to me. "That's the work of a coati," I said. A coati, Nasuirufa, is a Brazilian relative of the North American raccoon, notable for its alarmingly long claws, which it likes to keep sharp by scratching anything scratchable in sight, such as your favorite armchair or sofa. They can be domesticated, up to a point, if you don't mind having your furniture destroyed. A neighbor of mine in Rio de Janeiro had managed to tame one, and had plenty of scratched furniture as a result. The marks on her sofa looked exactly like those in the photos from Guarulhos. As I learned more about the case, it became clear that this was no ordinary poltergeist, or indeed any ordinary coati. Nor was the family affected typical. Marcos, a successful builder, and his wife Mia were evangelical Christians, as were his parents Pedro and Judite who lived next door. There was no obvious candidate for an epicenter who could be held responsible for the activity. The oldest child was only 4. Several members of the family concerned described having seen the slashes being produced. And that was not all they reported. Pedro gave a very precise description of what he saw. "It was like a vision, but I was wide awake with my eyes open and I saw the hand and arm of an animal, a very big and strong one. Very sharp claws 14 to 15 centimeters long, curved, black and shiny. Short red fur, like a cougar's. If I could draw, I could draw the hand perfectly, but I can't." In the house next door, Mia also had an alarming vision. "I was doing some sewing on the machine when I felt a shiver, and I looked round and saw the cuts appear on the mattress, and an animal that looked like a gorilla. It gave me goosebumps and I felt awful." She was telling a neighbor about this a day or two later, and then the neighbor saw a hand as well and fainted on the spot. Then money started to go missing, as did 2 door keys, and stones began to fall on the roof, a regular part of the Brazilian poltergeist repertoire. Then the physical attacks began. One night at around 3 a.m. Marcos woke up suddenly finding that he had a cut on his arm, which was beginning to bleed. Mia also woke up in time to catch a glimpse of some kind of animal beside the bed, but could not describe it in any detail. Then she was also scratched on the face, and the little daughter of a visitor had quite a nasty cut on her leg. Pedro next door was also cut on his face. Before long, the invisible beast was cutting everything in sight: sheet, blankets, clothing and even a pair of sandals and their wallet, as well as people. It also began to smash things and to start fires. It seemed about to embark on the entire repertoire of poltergeist trickery. Moving house was no help. Marcos got a big plumbing job in the nearby town of Torbate and rented a temporary house there, sending Mia to stay with relatives while he was away. In his new house, two of his Bibles were slashed to pieces, and money kept disappearing. It usually came back, often turning up in the most unlikely places, such as under a mattress. On one occasion he actually saw a bundle of notes drop onto the bed. Some plates that had gone missing in Garulhos were found under the bed in Torbate. A fire broke out inside his bag of tools. His wallet was found hanging from the ceiling light, well out of reach from the floor. And so on. Marcos then built himself a new house, and it was not long before the poltergeist moved in along with Mia and her two daughters, now aged 4 and 2. It all began again: fires, stones, cuts and scratches, money disappearing and alarming signs that the two little girls were suffering incipient obsession, though fortunately only briefly. Marcos repeatedly held prayer sessions in the house, but as he noted rather sadly, this only seemed to make things worse. Then there was a rather disturbing incident. One day, while Mia was alone in the house, two women turned up out of the blue, asking if they could use the toilet and if they could have a glass of water. One of them, she noticed, was carrying a plastic bag with some candles and cuttings of rosemary in it. One of the mysterious visitors said they had been sent to bless the house because something was not right. They refused to say who had sent them, and seemed determined to get inside the house. Mia managed to get rid of them, but they said they would be back. A couple of weeks later they were back, again when Mia was on her own. One of them produced a piece of cake, saying she had brought it for her and the children. Mia declined the offer, and once again refused to allow the uninvited women into the house. They had arrived by car, and she noticed that they had parked too far away for her to read the number plate. Soon after they left, she found a couple of her kitchen knives under bed, placed in the form of a cross. Marcos did not like the sound of all this, and began to suspect that somebody was doing a trabalho against him, although he could not think who would want to do such a thing. So once again he appealed to his church for help, and another prayer meeting was held in his house, which seemed to have some effect. Hernani took a special interest in this case and spent a great deal of time on it, visiting the family 7 times and recording several hours of interviews with Marcos, Mia and Pedro. His final report ran to 76 pages, making this one of the most thoroughly investigated cases of its type on record. While it was going on, he managed to fit in another investigation of a case alarmingly similar to the Garulhos one. This took place in the home of a Protestant family in the Vila Libanesa district of São Paulo, where 2 11-year-olds described being scratched by what they could only call a hairy animal with huge claws. There were also numerous instances of inexplicable outbreaks of fire. In 1984, 8 years after his 6th visit to Garulhos, Hernani went back to see how things were. It was now more than 10 years since the trouble had started in 1973, and it seemed that they had finally ended after a service conducted by members of the Assembly of God Church, apart from 1 or 2 brief outbreaks of small object movements and money disappearances, and a vision of what Mia took to be Satan, in the form of a hideously deformed human being who luckily did not reappear. Marcos told Hernani that he was sure somebody had cursed him, and the only possible suspects seemed to be 2 of his former girlfriends, the mother of one of whom was suspected to be involved in some kind of magic practices. And so yet again we find evidence that poltergeist phenomena are linked to the vengeful intentions of departed earthbound spirits. This is the interpretation that Brazilian spiritists would prefer.